So we're considering this morning Hebrews chapter 13, verses 7 to 16. And I think that verse 9 is a very important verse in this paragraph for enabling us to grasp something of the background to it. Because two things are immediately clear when you read verse 9. Number one, these readers are threatened by diverse and strange teachings, as he calls them. That's one thing that's clear. He says, don't be led away by these teachings. So they're clearly threatened by diverse and strange teachings. And then the second thing that's clear is that these diverse and strange teachings that they're threatened by, they have to do with food. Now, I guess it's perhaps surprising, isn't it, how many of the pastoral problems addressed within the New Testament epistles do have to do with food. So you think of 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10 in that whole block of the letter there. Paul is addressing the problem of Christian believers eating at pagan idol temples in Corinth. 1 Corinthians 11, of course, addresses the problem of Christians eating and drinking the Lord's Supper in such a way as highlighted the economic distinctions within the congregation and so undermined the unity of Christ's body. Romans 14 addresses the problem of Christians looking down on each other because of different opinions regarding what legitimately can be eaten by Christians. So all of that then raises the question, well, what precisely is the food-related problem that we have here in Hebrews 13? Well, I think we probably find the answer if we just turn back a couple of pages to Hebrews chapter 9 and verses 9 and 10, where we read this. I'll just read from the middle of verse 9. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshipper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. What is the author talking about there? Well, he's talking about the worship of the old covenant centered upon the tabernacle. And he indicates then that one aspect of that old covenant worship was eating and drinking. And of course it was, wasn't it? We know that from our Old Testaments. You think of Passover and that annual festival which the people of God celebrated. It involved, amongst other things, gathering, of course, for a special meal. Or then again, you could go to Leviticus 19, verses 5 to 8, and they give instructions for the eating of a sacrifice of peace offerings. Eating the sacrifice. Or then again, Leviticus 22, verses 29 and 30. And they give it, those verses give instructions for the eating of a sacrifice of thanksgiving. And so we could go on then with other examples from the law of Moses, sacrifices that were to be eaten in a special way. And the food-related problem then, here in Hebrews 13 verse 9, it has to do with these new covenant believers participating in these old covenant sacrificial meals. In other words, we're back here with basically the same problem that we've touched on again and again as we've gone through this letter of Hebrews, that some of these first readers were being drawn into the ancient rites and ceremonies of the law of Moses. And that being so, then, in this passage, just as in all those previous passages, our writer tackles the problem in this way. He points them to Jesus. He points them to Jesus. And here, then, in this passage, he points them to two things in particular. First of all, a detail concerning Jesus. A detail concerning Jesus, and we'll spend the vast majority of our time on this first thing. A detail concerning Jesus. And it really is a detail. It's a fine detail, we might almost say. What am I referring to? Well, the location of Jesus' crucifixion. Did you notice that as we read the passage? The writer makes quite a big deal of the location of Jesus' crucifixion. Now, of course, we all know the location was Golgotha, or Calvary, to use the Latin term. But Matthew, Mark, and John, they all refer, don't they, to Jesus' journey there, his journey to Golgotha, using a prefix, out. So Matthew and John, they both say, he went out. Mark, he says that Jesus was led out. John, additionally, tells us that this place, Golgotha, it was near the city. He didn't say it was near the stone pavement, Gabbatha, where Jesus had received his sentence from Pontius Pilate. He says it was near the city, which means, presumably, that it was actually outside the boundaries of the city. So it may or may not have been a green hill far away where our dear Lord was crucified, but certainly it was outside a city wall. We can be clear on that. And that's the detail then. That detail conveyed in those little prefixes, the detail conveyed in John's little preposition near, it's that detail that our writer here seems to pick up on. Jesus, he says in verse 12, Jesus suffered outside the gate. He suffered outside the gate. And so we need to ask, well, why does he pick up then on this detail? We might think, is it not a fairly incidental detail? It's just a factual detail of the crucifixion event. Why does our writer pick up on this? And why then does he point these readers who have been drawn into this old covenant stuff, why does he point them to this detail? Well, two reasons. First of all, it emphasizes Jesus' atonement. It emphasizes Jesus' atonement. Look at verse 11. And in verse 11 then, he says, "The bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp." What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about the focal point of Old Covenant worship, namely the annual Day of Atonement. He, of course, has already talked, hasn't he, about the Day of Atonement, particularly in chapter 9. And there in chapter 9, he highlighted the fact that on that annual Day of Atonement, the high priest had to have in his possession sacrificial blood. Blood was vital. He couldn't do what he had to do without blood. And so he says in chapter 9, when Jesus on that Good Friday shed his blood, he was fulfilling the Day of Atonement. He was the actual reality that it had always faintly pictured. Here now in chapter 13, he highlights another feature of the Day of Atonement, the way in which on that day those sacrificial animals were taken outside the camp. And he's making exactly the same point as he was in chapter 9. He's saying then that when on that Good Friday Jesus was taken outside the city, he was fulfilling the Day of Atonement. He was the actual reality to which it had always faintly pointed. And you see the writer's logic then. His logic is this, that if Jesus fulfilled at Calvary the very focal point of Old Covenant worship, the very centerpiece of Old Covenant worship, its very cornerstone, if you like, the Day of Atonement, if that has been, as it were, swallowed up now by the great event that took place at Golgotha, then certainly all the other components of Old Covenant worship have also been swallowed up, including these special meals that you guys are engaging in. That's his logic. He's saying it's massively inappropriate for you to be participating in these components of Old Covenant worship now that Jesus has emerged and by his death has swallowed up Old Covenant worship. He's fulfilled it all. In fact, he says in verses 9 and 10, two things about participating now in Old Covenant worship. For one thing, he says it's useless. He says, doesn't he, that those who are devoted to these foods, they haven't benefited at all from them. Well, they'll have benefited in the same way that you benefited from your breakfast this morning, from the protein content of those meals and from the calories and all the rest of it. But their hearts aren't being strengthened. He's saying when you go and you eat those special meals now, you readers of mine, it's not doing anything for you really. It's not actually strengthening your heart at all, because it's grace, he says, that strengthens our hearts. What does he mean by that? Well, I read at the start of our service, chapter 2, verse 9 of this letter, where you remember the writer connects grace with Jesus' death. Jesus, by the grace of God, tasted death for everyone. And so here then, when he says that our hearts as Christians are strengthened by grace, that's shorthand surely for the event of Calvary. It's by meditating on that. It's by surveying the wondrous cross. It's by focusing our hearts and our minds on Golgotha that our hearts are strengthened. Not by eating some food. That, by the way, is an important principle to bring with us into the Lord's Supper this morning, isn't it? It reminds us that in and of itself, this food won't strengthen our hearts either. It's bread and wine. It's the same nutritional value as any other bread and wine. It doesn't do anything for your heart. Your heart in the biblical sense of the word. It won't strengthen us if we're thinking about football as we eat and drink. Won't do anything for us then. No, it's as we survey the wondrous cross, for which the bread and the wine are such a helpful aid, it's as we do that that our hearts are strengthened. And what an opportunity it is then, the Lord's Supper, for us, month by month, or however often we celebrate it. What an opportunity to strengthen our hearts by gazing through the bread and the wine at the body and the blood of Jesus and engaging our hearts and minds with that event again. So the writer is saying, look, for you new covenant believers to be engaging in these old covenant meals, it's useless. But he also says something else. He says it's disastrous, actually. It's disastrous. Verse 10, he says, we have an altar. What does he mean by that? We have an altar? Well, he means Golgotha. The altar of Calvary, the altar of Jesus' cross where he was sacrificed, that's our altar. And then he says, from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. Now, that's not very helpful. It kind of sounds to us like he's talking about priests or Levites or something, officials who serve in that official sense at the tents. But of course, this is the same word that we've had back in chapter 12, verse 28. Let us offer to God acceptable worship. With reverence and awe. It can be just as well translated worship as serve. And so he's saying we have an altar from which those who worship at the tent have no right to eat. By eat there, he simply means have no right to avail themselves of. In other words, those who still carry on worshiping at the tent, worshiping in the old covenant way, they have no right to avail themselves of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ at Golgotha. You can't have both, he's saying. You can't worship in the old covenant way while benefiting from the sacrifice of Calvary. You can't have both the picture and the reality. No, now you've got the reality, the picture goes. That's his point. And so, for you new covenant believers to be still engaging in those old covenant meals. It's useless and it's potentially disastrous. So I hope you understand then how this detail then of Jesus suffering outside the gate, just like the animals on the Day of Atonement were burned outside the camp, it emphasizes that Jesus has fulfilled the Day of Atonement. It emphasizes that he is the reality to which it was always pointing. But just one question that might arise in our minds before we move on. And it's this. Is that not kind of undermined by what the writer goes on to say in verses 15 and 16? Because in verses 15 and 16, he talks about us offering sacrifices. That seems a bit two-faced of him, does it not? If Jesus has fulfilled the sacrifices, and they're not to engage in the sacrificial meals now because Jesus has fulfilled all the sacrifices, why are they to offer sacrifices? Why is he contradicting himself? Well, of course, the point is this, that new covenant believers, Christians, we do offer sacrifices, but sacrifices of a very, very different sort. Bloodless sacrifices. Sacrifices that have no association whatsoever with atonement. I mean, you see this, don't you, in Paul's letter to the Romans. You remember how in the great kind of central part of Romans, there in chapter 3, he's so emphatic, isn't he? In chapter 3, verse 25, emphatic about Jesus. God has put him forward as a propitiation by his blood. Jesus is the sacrifice. He's the one who propitiates the wrath of God. He's so emphatic. Jesus, Jesus, he's the sacrifice. Then, of course, you come to Romans 12, verse 1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. And in chapters 12 to 14 of that letter, he goes into great detail about what these sacrifices then that we Christians offer should look like. In chapter 12, it should be loving our enemies. Chapter 13, submitting to the authorities. Chapter 14, being gracious toward brothers and sisters who have different opinions from ourselves on indifferent matters. And so on. That's what these bloodless Christian sacrifices look like. And it's the same in Hebrews then. Yes, Jesus is the sacrifice, and no book of the New Testament is more emphatic on that than Hebrews is. Indeed, this very passage, as we've seen, is emphatic on that. He's the fulfillment of the Day of Atonement. But nonetheless, as those who benefit from his atoning sacrifice, we offer sacrifices, not atoning sacrifices. Sacrifices of transformed lives. And he shows us what it looks like as well, doesn't he? In less detail than Romans 12 to 14, but there are at least three components. Worship, verse 15. Through him, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That is the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. Then good works, do not neglect to do good. And then he kind of specifies one particular good work and to share what you have. Such sacrifices are pleasing to God. So we say sometimes, don't we, that the great thing about, or one of the great things about our new covenant worship, our Lord's Day worship, is that we don't come to offer sacrifices. We don't come dragging a sheep with us or a goat. We don't come smelling the smell of animal blood as it flows down the altar. And that's true, and that's wonderful. But in another sense, we do come this morning to offer sacrifices. These sacrifices of verse 15, sacrifices of praise. The sacrifices of our lips as we sing the praises of the God who has saved us by grace. And this week then, as I was saying in my prayer earlier on, we go into this week, don't we? seeking to perform good works, which in the terminology of our text is offering sacrifices. In your workplace, in your home, in your school, wherever you are this week, obeying Jesus Christ, in a sense, you are offering sacrifices to him. As you do good, as you're kind, as you're helpful, as you're pure, as you're just and fair, as you're a good husband, a good wife, an obedient child to your parents, in all these ways, you are offering sacrifices that are pleasing to God. And so, this then is the first reason that our writer points his readers to this strange detail. Jesus dying outside the camp, outside the gate, because it emphasizes Jesus' atonement. But then the second reason, it exposes their aspirations. This detail, it exposes their aspirations. Because notice that verse 13, it applies this detail of Jesus being sacrificed outside in quite a different way, doesn't it? Verse 13 says, "Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured." Now, I think we need to pause for a moment and think, why is it that these readers are being drawn into this old covenant-style worship? Why is that? Well, we've said quite often what the main reason probably is, and it's this, that they were tiring somewhat of the sheer bareness and simplicity of New Covenant worship. The invisibility of it all. Yes, we have a priest, but we can't see him. Yes, there's a temple, but we can't see it. And they were attracted by the sheer tangibility of the Jerusalem setup. Priests in their flowing robes that you could see, and the building that was such a grand piece of architecture. And there was something so physical about it all. Such pomp and ceremony attached to it all. And it seems then that that was probably the main reason that they were being drawn into this stuff. But there was also another reason. And it's this. They are almost certainly, as we've said time and again, Jews. These are Jewish Christians. And it seems then that they want acceptance and approval from their Jewish compatriots. And in particular, they want the acceptance and approval of the city of Jerusalem. I mean, think about, I guess it's hard for us to imagine just how important Jerusalem was to them as Jews, who were probably diaspora Jews. They're not living in Jerusalem themselves. Perhaps they're in Rome. That seems the most likely possibility. They may be somewhere else, but they're probably not living in Jerusalem. And that would have probably only intensified their passion for Jerusalem. You know what it's like when you live away from your home place. You kind of get more passionate about your home place, don't you? And they would have been so passionate then as diaspora Jews about Jerusalem. It was the center of the Jewish world. And what a privilege and what a special thing it would have been whenever they had the opportunity to visit their home city, Jerusalem. And it seems then that when they did visit Jerusalem, they just wanted to be able to walk around its streets with their heads held high. They wanted to be able to walk around Jerusalem feeling part of it, feeling like they belonged there. But of course, as long as they were living strictly as Christians, they couldn't really do that, because their non-participation in all the rites and the ceremonies that were still going on in Jerusalem, it just stood out like a sore thumb. It made them look like strange aliens in the place, outsiders. They probably got funny looks whenever they visited Jerusalem. They felt like they didn't really belong there. because they weren't participating in all the rites and ceremonies. But if, on the other hand, they could go to Jerusalem and they could take part in some of these sacrificial meals, perhaps on Passover, perhaps on other occasions, well, that just put a different complexion on everything. Suddenly, people looked at them differently. People warmed to them. They were owned. They were embraced as real Jews then. And so you can see how it was so attractive for them. Wanting this acceptance and approval to participate in these sacrificial meals. Well, what our writer is saying in verse 13 is this. He's saying, look, your aspirations to acceptance and approval from your Jewish compatriots, those are wrong aspirations. They're wrong aspirations. And here's why. Jesus, he says, was crucified outside the city. And his crucifixion outside the city, yes, it was partly a matter of Roman logistics. That's just where they executed people. But it also expressed a Jewish rejection of Jesus. I mean, it was written into the law of Moses. You can look it up in Leviticus 24, verse 14, that blasphemers had to be killed outside the camp. It's there in that verse. The blasphemers had to be killed outside the camp. And of course, Jesus, in the eyes of the Sanhedrin, in the eyes of the Jerusalem religious leaders, he was a blasphemer. And so I'm saying it was no coincidence that he was taken out there to be executed. It symbolized, it expressed powerfully the Jews' rejection of him, the city's rejection of him. They were expelling him, they were chucking him out. They were evicting him, if you like. That's what they were doing in making him be crucified outside the city. And our writer is saying then, look, to identify with Jesus, which is what you did at conversion, when you became Christians, to identify with Jesus is to identify with a Jerusalem reject. A man that that city did not want. A man that that city threw out to the rubbish dump outside its walls. And his point is then that to be seeking the approval and acceptance from Jerusalem while simultaneously identifying as Christians with the one who was rejected by Jerusalem, that is just an unsustainable contradiction. That's his point. He's saying the Jesus that you came to at conversion was the banished, exiled, rejected Jesus. And so you need to keep going to him. Therefore, let us go to him. You came to that Jesus at conversion. Keep daily going out to that Jesus. It's the only Jesus there is. There isn't a socially acceptable Jesus. There's only the Jesus who was kicked out of the streets of Jerusalem. And so he's saying that crucifixion outside the city, not only does it emphasize Jesus' atonement, he's fulfilled that great annual festival, but it also exposes their wrong aspirations. They are looking for approval from the very city that rejected their Jesus. And can we not say by extension that our aspirations are also wrong whenever we crave acceptance and approval from our culture, from our society? Remember how Jesus says, doesn't he, in John 15, verse 18, the world hates me. Didn't just say that the Jews hate me, the Sanhedrin hate me, the Jerusalem elite hate me. No, the world hates me. In other words, rejection of Jesus isn't just a Jewish thing. It isn't just a Jerusalem thing. It's the default position of all societies and all cultures and all cities. And in that sense, then, when Jesus was kicked out of Jerusalem on Good Friday, Jerusalem represented all the world cities throughout all the ages. That is to say, our culture, the society that we're in Great Britain in 2017, it was implicated in the rejection of Jesus Christ on Good Friday. It was kicking him out of its streets as well. This world around us this morning, it's the world that Jesus says hates me. It's the world that evicted him so forcibly. And for us too then, to seek its approval, whether at the individual level, by laughing at its dirty jokes in the playground at school, drinking its quantities of alcohol on a Friday night, adopting its approach to Sunday, or whether at the church level, moderating the exclusiveness of the Christian gospel to pander to our culture, ignoring the Bible's condemnation of homosexual practice to pander to our culture. At whatever level it might be, to seek this world's approval while identifying with the Saviour who was rejected by this world, it's an unsustainable contradiction. We go to Jesus outside the camp, outside of our culture and its norms, outside of this world that hates Jesus. We go to him there. We don't seek to refashion Jesus into a Jesus that our culture will accept. We go to the only real Jesus that there is, the hated Jesus, the evicted Jesus. That's what our passage is saying to us this morning. And that's hard, isn't it? There are a couple of encouragements here, perhaps. First of all, the way he says that we go to him, verse 13, bear the reproach he endured. And then you link that back with chapter 12, verse 2, that Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame. And remember we said when we talked about that text, that the shame of Jesus at Calvary, it had two dimensions, a horizontal dimension and a vertical dimension. Horizontally, there was the shame before men of being naked and being taunted throughout those hours of the crucifixion. But vertically, there was the shame of bearing all our guilt before the holy and awesome God. Well, when our writer now says in verse 13 that we go out to him bearing his reproach, it's only one of those dimensions, isn't it? We share with him the horizontal reproach, the taunts, the ostracism perhaps. We don't share with him the vertical shame. He took it on our behalf, in our place. He was ashamed before God that we might stand before God on Judgment Day unashamed. And that's a wonderful thing to remember. And then also look at what he says in verse 14. He says, here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. Where he's saying to these readers, look, this Jerusalem that you're so into, that you want the approval of, this Jerusalem, it's going to be included in the shaking I've talked about in chapter 12. The grand cosmic shaking. Jerusalem's walls and its buildings will all collapse on that day. Jerusalem's not going to last. But we have a better Jerusalem, a better city that we're looking forward to. So remember that when you have to go outside the city and you have to hear the taunts and the whispers of the city. Remember, it's not really your city. You're looking forward to a better one. And the same for us today. That whenever we feel the taunts and the shame of our society because we're Christians, let's remember that this isn't where we belong. This isn't our home. We're heading for a better place, where we do belong, where our names, as we saw the other week, are written. So I said we would take up almost all our time on that detail concerning Jesus. Just very briefly as we close, the dependability of Jesus. The dependability of Jesus, because we haven't touched on verse 8, those famous words, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. Partly, I think, that belongs to the motif that we've seen throughout the letter of Jesus as a sympathetic high priest. Remember, he said that 2 or 3 times about Jesus' sympathy now in heaven as he is at God's right hand. And he's sympathetic then on the basis that he was tempted in every way just as we are. But the objection that we might raise to that is, hang on a minute, Jesus isn't now on earth. He isn't now in that humiliated form. He's now resurrected, glorified, exalted. Is there really any meaningful continuity between the Jesus who was tempted in Gethsemane, for instance, and the Jesus who now is my high priest at God's right hand? And I rightly say, yes, there's absolute continuity. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He remembers, in other words, everything that he endured. He hasn't now kind of been exalted so high that he's kind of moved beyond any recall of what he experienced here on earth. It's now just this alien past to him that he doesn't have any sense of any longer. No, he remembers. He's the same Jesus. And so he is compassionate and sympathetic toward you. But the main point he's making here, surely in the context, is this, that Jesus Christ is not just the same now as he was when he lived on earth. Yes, that is a sub-point, but the main point is this. Jesus Christ is the same now as he was when your leaders, that is the evangelists who first came to your city, when they preached him to you then, he's the same now as he is then. And the point is that on that day, when they came and preached to you about Jesus, you found that gospel so liberating. Wow, Jesus has come and has fulfilled all the types, all the shadows. He's the fulfillment of the Day of Atonement. And then you found that liberating and you rejoiced and you were willing to sacrifice anything because you'd found the gospel. You were willing to get rid of all your possessions. The authorities could take them. You didn't care less. Why? Because you'd found Jesus, the fulfillment of all the Old Testament. And here you are now, several years later, and now you're tired and you're weary and you're going back to sacrificial meals in Jerusalem. What's changed? Has Jesus changed? Is he less the fulfillment of the Day of Atonement now than he was 10 years ago when you were converted? Is he less now than he was when those preachers came and preached him so powerfully to you? No, Jesus hasn't changed. It's you that's changed. You've moved. Jesus hasn't moved. Jesus is exactly where he was then. Still the Saviour, the fulfillment of the promises. You've moved. So come back. Come back to the Jesus who caused you such joy then. Come back. And I would say the same to anyone this morning who is beginning to drift. And you're beginning just to get weary of Christianity. And the gospel doesn't excite you. And you're cold in your heart. And my question is, go back to when you were converted and the joy you felt in those early days and ask the question, what's changed? Jesus or me? Jesus hasn't changed. Just think of the joy that once was yours and think, I need to go back to that Jesus and re-embrace him this morning and rededicate my life to him this morning. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Amen.